where possible, the pleasure given to the self. But in thinking about that, Freud noticed this important point, which is very important for Lacan, which is why I'm stressing it. When you seize upon a pleasure-giving object, let us say chocolate, then there is the initial excitation, this chocolate tastes good, and you eat some more chocolate and it tastes good, and you eat some more chocolate and it's starting to pour, and eventually you come to a point where the system can't take any more. At that point, says Freud, the system seems to reset itself at a lower level of excitation. And what that means is that any pleasure-giving entity or object has a limited utility as far as pleasure is concerned. After a bit, it stops giving pleasure. And therefore, the pleasure impulse has to direct itself elsewhere, to some different food, to drink, to, or you can pursue drink and eventually it will damage you or kill you, and people will actually do that. Rarely, that's alcoholism. So that's the first point. Secondly, what the ego does, its primary function, is that it is a survival mechanism. All entities have this way of interacting with the reality principle in order to prevent the entity from coming to harm. So anything that comes into your awareness, you have to decide whether it's going to hurt you or kill you or not, and whether you should take evasive or combative action. And actually that is the primary function of the ego, because survival is the thing that matters most. Therefore the ego is always protecting you and itself, because the ego makes no difference between the two, from death. The ego is a way of avoiding death. Now, how does Lacan deal with that? He says, oh yeah, wait a minute, no, I'll do the death. I think I'll do the death wishes next. Yeah. Now, Freud, when he was dealing with people after the First World War, after, as I say in my introductory lectures, he had a problem, because people were coming to him with post-traumatic stress disorder, and a prominent symptom of post-traumatic stress disorder, or as it was called then, shell shock, is that you exactly relive the traumatic event that caused the lesion, the wound, the trauma. You relive it. In extreme cases, it actually visits you in ordinary life, so that suddenly there you are, bang, back in where you were when you experienced the horror that has driven you to this state. Or more commonly, in dreams, you can't sleep at night, because whenever you sleep, you are back there in the trenches, seeing your best friend's head fall off, or whatever it is that happened. Now, big problem for Freud, because of course for Freud every dream is the fulfillment of a secret wish. That is really fundamental to all of Freud's way of looking at the world. He can't abandon that, therefore, being an extraordinarily daring, not to say outrageous thinker, he invented a wish that in order to overcome this obstacle to his theory, and the wish is the death wish, which he also called Thanatos, T-H-A-N-A-T-O-S, Greek word for death. Eros, the pleasure principle, Thanatos, the death principle. So what he said was that when you relive a traumatic event in a dream, you do this because you have a very deeply buried secret desire to die. And this death wish, in normal people, is more in abeyance in the early part of life, and and the pleasure principle is upmost. But as you get older, the death wish becomes more prominent and the pleasure principle becomes less prominent, and eventually the death wish wins and you die. If at the age 18 you're flung into the trenches and you see the most horrible things and you are driven mad by this, then what happens is that the death wish becomes much too prominent, and it would be the job of psychoanalysis to adjust that situation by working your way through why it is. I would have thought that what the analyst would try to do would be to go back into your early childhood and see what events took place there that made you vulnerable to the trauma. So that's a conjecture, but I would assume that's why he's doing it. Now, I don't think anybody thinks that this is a particularly convincing solution to the problem. The death wish is, you know, how can you have a Darwinian solution to the death wish? How would Darwin say this is something that evolution would have selected for? Wanting to die? Come on, evolution selects for that which enables you to survive. So this is a problem in Freud. Along comes Jacques Lacan, translating Freud into French and changing it radically as he does, and he has a solution to this problem. So I'll now give you his solution to the problem. Lacan says, here you are, this totally summarizes it. No, I'm looking up into space. Lacan says that every pleasure wish is also a death wish. What? How do you get that? All right, here's the first way in which he makes that strange equation. He says that when you follow the pleasure principle, unconsciously you are aware of the fact that that will lead to, that will not satisfy you. That the pleasure object that you're fixing upon, whether it's chocolate or the next drink or the loved one in a sexual fantasy or whatever, you know that it won't satisfy you, so that in operating the pleasure principle, which will give you pleasure, you are also operating a principle that will bring you unpleasure, because any pleasure eventually brings you unpleasure, and the ultimate unpleasure is death, so the two drives are in fact the same. The pleasure principle and the unpleasure principle are operating with the same object in mind. This is because, for Lacan, what powers the whole thing is not eros, which is essentially sexual, but désir, desire. And fundamental to Lacan is the notion that what you think you desire is not what you desire. Desire is always, in Lacan, addressed to the wrong object. all of your desire, says Lacan, is addressed towards the real. But since the real cannot be contained in a world that has a subject, i.e. you, you must be completely unaware that that's actually what you want. You are constructed from dreams and language. The imaginaire, the symbolique. When that construction takes place, something gets excluded. Language excludes that which cannot be spoken. Language selects. Can you get this idea that language is actually a very thin, a very... is a listing of the world. And you know that the world can't be listed. There, how about that? The world cannot be listed. There are too many things in it. And anything... I mean, supposing I started to list the characteristics of the stone, right? So... here's language operating, it does classification, that's what it's most comfortable with. It says it's a stone. And so having said that it's a stone, then we know that it's not going to threaten me because stones are inert, right? And we know what stones are like, they're hard and they have weight and stuff like that. So that slots it into a system and it means that I can go on my way because I know what it is. But supposing I were actually to specify its characteristics, and then I start talking about its colour, and then I just start talking about its exact weight, and I start talking about the pattern on it, and I go on talking about it, and it is clear that I could go on talking about it forever, and I would still not exactly and completely specify what it is. Does that make sense? Right. Words don't do the whole job. They give the appearance of doing the whole job. When you read a novel, what does that novel consist of? It consists of utterly and only words. But when you are reading that novel, you think you're in a world. Some more than others, and some more than others with particular novels. A novel that has that really powerful world-creating capacity is a highly valued artifact, such that we pay novelists who can create it, such as the Harry Potter woman, we pay her limitless sums of money. Think how much she earns. How come she earns that much? Because she can create a world with words that people want to live in. Amazing. Even very bad writers like Geoffrey Archer, is he a name that you are familiar with? Anyone not? Geoffrey Archer? No, well, that's because you're a foreigner. Geoffrey Archer wrote a series of thrillers, and he became so rich that he bought the house in Grantchester in Cambridge, where Rupert Brooke wrote the poem Is the Honey Still for Two, which is a famous poem. And he also bought an apartment flat overlooking the Thames, view of the Thames in London, and you go in there and there are, the first thing you see is a Henry Moore statue. He was ridiculously rich because of writing half a dozen actually very, very bad novels. And I met him once. He was at the university at the same time as I was. Very nasty piece of work, I thought. That was before he was rich, of course. The world cannot be expressed in words. It is clear that the world cannot be expressed in words. But we think that it does. I tell you this, but you... I don't really, at a fundamental level, believe it. I think that I live in a... in the linguistically constructed world that I live, I believe in it. And I behave at a very deep level as if it was all there is. Although I know intellectually that it is not all it is, that it is not all there is. What Lacan says is that we have an unconscious awareness of the real world as it is, or at least we have an unconscious and very powerful desire for the real world as it is beyond language. And that is the desire that drives us always onwards. But since we are unconscious of this real world, it cannot be perceived by us because we are made of dreams and words, then it always eludes us, and what we do is we constantly and continually fall in love with substitutes, like chocolate, like another drink, like a nice car. And once you've got the nice car, it's after a bit, it's no longer so nice because you're used to it. There is a habituation principle going on. And so you have to look for something else to fall in love with, and something else. But what you are actually in love with, that coffee is called Eros. That is strange. Whose coffee is it? Where did you get it from?
Downstairs.
In my house.
They sell coffee called Eros down there.
Mm. I don't know.
That's a synchronistic event. And if you're in a Jungian seminar, then we could make a much out of this, whereas Lacan doesn't believe in synchronicity. Okay, so far. You with me? You following? This is a very, very difficult thing to do because I'm trying to talk about that which you can't talk about it. So, if I'm successful about talking about it, I wreck it. You see, I have to give you the fact that you can't talk about it as well as talking about it. This is very, very difficult. So that map there, barred S, diamond, big A over little a, expresses that situation. The split subject is constructed in relation to the other capital O, which represses the other small o. Now, there are two ways that are a more appropriate. We wrestle with this problem. We desire that which we can't possibly have or even know about. How do we get round that? Lacan has two ways. He thinks it important first that we should allow big A into our lives. Big A comes into our lives through dreams, through big A, ultra, other, the unconscious, through slips of the tongue. Big A is when it speaks, sapal, and that is the initial function of Lacanian psychoanalysis. You are there, sitting on your chair, opposite the analyst, and you are spieling forth your stuff, which is all coming from the ego, and it's false speech, and the analyst is waiting for it to speak. For your ego speech, your false speech, to be interrupted. What interrupts it is big A, and when big A interrupts it, then truth is told. And that is a signal that you can, that you should attempt to incorporate this truth into your life. This can be done in fiction because that's what surrealist poetry does. Sorry, in literature because that's what surrealist poetry does. When it says the unexpected, when it shocks you, when it presents you with a fantasy landscape that is somehow true, then you are encountering the grandeur. As far as I can make out, there are two kinds of discourse in Granda. One is purely linguistic, and that is the discourse that rhymes, the discourse that is non-consecutive, the discourse that is apparently nonsensical but actually makes a deep sense. And the nearest we can get to that is something like surrealist poetry. There is another kind of set of phenomena that seem to be going on there, and that is the repressed imaginary, which we entered into in the mirror phase. Now, what the imaginary, the imaginaire is like, it is, imagine that there you are, you're a child, you don't have language, you have no control, you can't slot things into places, that's a stone, because you don't have language, which is what does that. You see images, and they transform weirdly into other images. They don't seem to have any rhyme or reason, and it's all a bit scary because you're not in control, but it's also very vivid and powerful, and there is wonder in there. You are in the imaginaire, without doubt, in Wonderland. And like Alice, you are scared and fascinated and puzzled and in danger, and nothing behaves the way you want it to behave. If you want to grow, you can't grow. Or if you, and you, strange transformations of shape take place. So the smile, the cat turns into a smile. Now, cats do many things, but smiling is not one of them. The smile of the cat is a purely imaginary phenomenon in the deepest sense. It's something that you can visualize and imagine, but does not happen in nature. No cat smiles. Let alone does any cat vanish, leaving a... Do you know what I'm talking about? This is Alice in Wonderland. You know about the Cheshire Cat, right? This huge cultural sort of phenomenon. Everybody... Does anyone not know about the Cheshire Cat? Isn't that interesting? So that is also a component of Big A Wonderland. Scary, illusory, fantastic, metamorphosing, weird, full of secrets and knowledge that you can't get your head around. And of course the literature, there is a vast range of literature that deals with that. Fairy tales, fantasy fiction, the Gothic. And that is why we think that those stories are true, because they speak from the unconscious. Although we know, that is why we think that they are true, although we know rationally that they are not true. That is why they have power over us. That is why we read the book. Okay, so recap. Big A, two components, imaginary and weird linguistic. The speech that is never spoken, weird linguistic. Imaginary comes in through the Gothic and fantasy, weird linguistic through surrealism, surrealist poetry. I probably said last week, surrealist poetry is not commonly found in English. Because English is a commonsensical language, and one of the fundamental English attitudes is come off it. Come on, don't be ridiculous like that. But strangely, there is a whole area of poetry in English that is world famous and is very, very much uses the surreal. Do you know what this area of the poetry is?
Romantic.
What?
Romantic.
That's not what I'm thinking of. That's true. Yeah, romantic uses the Gothic. Yeah, that's not what I'm thinking of. It's pop music. Pop music. Bob Dylan met the Beatles. Bob Dylan was into LSD. Bob Dylan comes from was in New York, and he was in the New York culture, and he was reading Verlaine and Mallarmé and the French surrealist poets. Combination of French surrealism and LSD gives you surrealism. Dylan brought surrealism into pop music, and all pop musicians, all writers of lyrics adopted it because it makes the rhyme so much easier to get, because you can say whatever you bloody well like, you know. Any word that comes into your head you can stick down, and it makes the rhymes easier to do. Previous to that, people were rhyming moon with June with tune, and love with dove, and remember with September. And once you've done that a few times, you get very bored, right? That's what music was like before Dylan and the Beatles came along. I vaguely remember it. So that's a curious phenomenon. It is actually very much part of our lives because we all listen to this music. If you actually pay attention to the words, then you will find that there's a considerable degree of surrealism there. Right. What then about little A? Little A is that part of language, that part of the unconscious discourse that enables the beginnings of a perception of the real. As such, it is suppressed by big A, because all of A, big or little, is discursive, is linguistic, and is other language, is unconscious language, it is other language, it is language that doesn't obey the rules, it is the unspeakable in language. All of A is like that. But big A is the language of the possibly accessible unconscious, so that you can actually hear and be interrupted by this discourse. Little A is that part of other language which you can't hear, it doesn't interrupt, it has to come at you from different directions, from a mysterious direction. It is utterly unspeakable, and because of that, it can point to that which cannot be perceived or seen or heard or understood, and that is the real. So here we get to the crunch, the paradox. I mean, what the hell is he talking about? You know, it therefore doesn't exist. Well, yeah, it does exist. It has to exist because it is clear that language doesn't describe everything. That there is an everything out there. And if it can't be described by language, then I, who am linguistically created, cannot be there. That's what that lausete bit is about. It is a subjectless domain. I can't be there. Le moi cannot be there. But that is the real object of our desire. That's what we want. Little A. Now, in Lacanian psychotherapy, how does it work? All right, first I have to explain about jouissance. The way in which you experience any of the other, big or little, A, is with jouissance. And what jouissance is pleasure pain. because it is a paradox, pleasure pain, it enables you to push through, or at least push at the edges of, the limitations of language. That enables a perception of the paradoxical language of Big A, but it also ultimately enables a perception of the impossible language of Little A. Now, here's the therapeutic situation. You go to your analyst with a problem, and do not mistake that your problem is serious, okay? I mean, plenty of people, I imagine, would have gone to Lacan because that would be an interesting thing to do. But there are plenty of people in the world who are mentally ill, who are neurotic, who are highly disturbed, and they are desperate. They will do anything to get out of this situation because it is painful. What Lacan says is it is also pleasurable. There is a jouissance of the neurosis, and that's why you've got it. Because it is attractive as well as being unpleasant. And what Lacan says is that it is the function of the analyst. What the analyst should do is that she should enable, she should come from the position of little a, because that's where your real desire is. If she can do that, then she will evoke an extreme jouissance. And if she can do that, then what will happen is that the jouissance of the neurosis will be supplanted, replaced by the jouissance of the analysis. And you'll be cured. Do you understand that? Oh God. Silence. Come on, feed me back. No.
So you're always looking for pleasure.
What?
You're always looking for pleasure, and so if you create a neurosis, it's because you are finding pleasure in it, even if you don't recognise it. And in order to get rid of it, you go to an analyst who will give you and something to basically replace it, so the analysis...
Something other to replace it,
So you're still looking for that pleasure because you're constantly looking for
pleasure. It's your desire.
Because your real desire will never be fulfilled, so you're always looking for something.
Yeah, that's true.
Are symptoms jouissance?
There is a jouissance in the symptom.
So is analysis about replacing a symptom with a symptom?
No. Analysis... Ah.
Alex is going to be dead.
Yeah. No. As far as I understand it, analysis is about replacing the jouissance of the symptom with the jouissance of the analysis, which is not itself a symptom. It's not a problem, it's a solution. And the reason why it's a solution is because it locates itself in the real of your desire. You have the symptom because your desire is located in an illusory position. Good question.
I can't write these things down fast enough before I forget them.
Are you making a tape? Somebody make it tape?
Yeah.
What format does it come out in?
MP3.
Can you email it to me? Mm. And I'll put it on the web so that you can podcast it. I'll podcast. Is that all right? So how does the analyst do that? by always frustrating you. Because what you want is that the analyst should be the sujet supposé savoir, the subject who is supposed to know, right? I think this is a brilliant Lacanian formulation. So there they are, the analyst and the analyst and what the analyst is trying to do is to get the analyst to be the person who provides a verbal net that will contain the situation, because that is the false desire that will satisfy falsely the desire of the analyst wants you to be like daddy and to incorporate it all into language so that everything is understood and your ego will be reinforced. That's what American Freud does, right? Builds up the ego because the ego is constructed of language and dreams, builds up the language of the ego by providing you with solutions. Aha! This is nothing but a misplaced Oedipal fixation, which came about because your mother had an affair when you were 3 years old. Aha! Words. Words. And the ego think, great! I can do that. I understand that because it's language. And then the ego thinks, but how come I don't feel better? Oh, well, you go back to the next analytic session and pay some more money to the analyst. Comme ça, like that. Whereas what the Lacanian analyst does is to utterly refuse that. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. You know what the answer is. I don't. Your other inside you knows what the answer is. Keep turning it back, just like a Freudian, classic Freudian analysis. They always ask questions, they never give answers, but much more so because it comes from a really shocking place. It's like, as I said before, I don't know if I said it to you, it's like you go to Jung and at some point he'll do magic. And that magic will turn you around and hopefully and revive your life because you will become part of a wonderful story. That's the Jungian therapeutic technique. But there has to be magic, okay? It has to be something you can't get your head around. Because if the ego can get its head around it, then you're doomed because the ego is the problem. If the ego takes possession of it, if it feels good in that superficial way, then you have a real problem. It has to be disturbing. It has to be destabilizing. And the Lacanian will use will use the analytic session, will use language to destabilize itself. So simple example is the but kind of horrifying is what you know about the variable analytic hour for Lacan. In classic Freud, it's like sacrosanct, it's sacred. 50 minutes, that's what the analytic hour is, and that's what you're paying for. You turn up and you get your 50 minutes, right? However, what Lacan says is, if you do that, then the ego will put off, will watch the clock, and will put off allowing it to speak until the last possible moment, and then when it starts speaking, it will be time to go, and the whole thing ends. So he invented the notion of the variable analytic hour. At any point during that 50 minutes, the analyst could say, right, that's it. Go. Finish.
Would they still charge you the full amount?
And still charge you the full amount, yes. And it was widely noticed that Lacan never varied it by making it go over. It was always under. Well, you can't make it go over because you've got another client coming in, you know, on the hour. And you think, you know, the bloody charlatan, the bastard, you know. And that's what you meant. That's part of it. That is part of it. Trickster, right? Trying to destabilize you in a way that you will find really painful. And paying, you know, 50 minutes worth of money for 5 minutes worth of analysis. is certainly painful, believe me. But think what it does. It gives you what Buddhists call death awareness, because there you are, and you never know, at some minute, the axe is going to fall. And so you're going to be so focused. You're so awake, so alive. That's the theory, anyway. That's the kind of shocking thing that he would do. Now, what I'm going to do is talk about poetry, right? And I'm going to, because poetry can, not only surrealist poetry like the Lorca, can give you words that don't make sense, that have a profound effect on you, as in that Lorca death poem, but can also come at you from where little A is, because what they do is that they give you, they open up a gap where there are no words. Poetry can do that. Now, the easiest way to do this, you're going to have to bear with me on this, the easiest way to do this is to talk about the poetry of a culture where that particular vision of the real is actually not only accepted, but is actually widely reinforced and believed in. So this is Japanese culture, and I'm going to talk about haiku. Haiku are widely used by Zen poets, and what Zen is about is that moment of realization, that moment where there are no words, that moment where you come into an appreciation of what everything actually is like, and you can't talk about it. And this is devastating, painful, and reportedly wonderful. And the Japanese word for that is Satori, S-A-T-O-R-I. So I can tell you what this is like by talking about the poetry that tries to evoke this feeling. And then I'll talk about English poetry, but I probably won't get onto the English poetry bit until next week, so you would have to wait for that. So in 1742, a Buddhist nun called Chiyun-ni, early one morning, a beautiful morning, went to get the water from the well, because that was her job. And she came to the well bucket, and it was completely covered with morning glory flowers. Now, does anybody know what morning glory is? Amazing. Not one student knows what morning glory is. It's quite weird. Morning glory is a kind of vine, right? So it spreads very fast, and it has great big beautiful bell-like flowers. They really are big like that, but that size. And it's profuse, okay? So you see morning glory overhanging a bush, and it's kind of overwhelming because it's so beautiful and there's so much of it. And the really strange thing about it is that very early in the morning, at night time, there's nothing there. And then dawn comes up and it starts to grow, and it grows very fast. So quite early in the morning, you've got these big bell-like flowers, and they last exactly one day, and then they die. And then next morning, up it comes again. Okay. The nun sees that the well bucket has been completely overgrown with morning glory flowers, and because of that, a gap is opened in her mind, and she experiences Satori. It can be anything. That's what it was with her. The reason why it happened for her, though, is because she's a nun, right? She has spent many, many, many hours in sitting meditation trying to train her mind to be receptive of this experience. And so she was devastated, and she came back to the monastery in floods of tears, and all she could say was, "Ah, the morning glory. Ah." and it was recognized that she had had a Satori experience, and actually a very powerful one. And in Japan, you get great honor for this because it means that you're spiritually advanced. And eventually, because she was an accomplished haiku poet, she sat down, she wrote a poem about it. This is the poem. Morning glory, the well bucket is tangled, seek water elsewhere. Because the well bucket was tangled up with morning glory, she had to go to some other method of getting water. Now, I present that to English students who are very accustomed to and skilled at looking at poetry, and they look at that and they think, what the hell's going on? You can't talk about that. What is that? What is that? Well, what is happening is that in Japanese, the key thing is that space there, which is expressed by a syllable that is not semantic. So the beginning of that poem, the words morning glory, and then the word ya, Y-A. And that word is designed to open a space. It is a marker that says, at this point, contemplate what I've just said. And what you're supposed to do, if you have the practice and the training and you are skilled at reading haiku, is to go, ah, like that. There are no words. And to, in some small way, to repeat the experience of the real through object. So that is object pretty at those three dots there that are not verbal. I can better explain that by talking about this poem here. This poem is the greatest work of literature in the whole of Japanese. So it's like, we got Hamlet, right? Thousands of words, huge emotions, lots of stuff, they got that. What that says is, furu ike, furu means old, ike means pond, except the English word is much too low and colloquial. It should be something like sort of pool or something like that, because when a Japanese sees furu ike, they think, ah, yes, beautiful, calm, ancient, tranquil, peaceful. Ya is the kireji, it's the space word. It is, look at what I've just said. So what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to experience this beautiful. And then kawazu, frog, tobikomu. Tobi means jump, komu means enter in. So a frog jumps in, old pond, frog jumps in, water of, i.e. of water, the sound, misu no oto, the sound of water. That's what it means. Frog jumps, old pond, frog jumps, splash. That's the poem. That's the greatest work of Japanese literature. I have spent years trying to get my head wrapped up. Years. Went to Japan, asked people about it. Came back here, and eventually what I did was I organized a seminar of Japanese experienced teachers of English. They were over here learning about how to be teachers of English, but they're advanced, right? They're experienced teachers of English. So I organized this seminar, and the seminar was about that. So I said, okay, explain this to me. And they looked at me as if I was some sort of bloody barbarian and said, we don't do that. And I said, what do you mean you don't do that? And they said, we do not talk about this. Okay, you want to be a teacher of English. In England, we do talk about this. If you want to learn, do it. So they went round and round, because there are huge politeness rules in Japan, of course, and you've got to please the teacher. But on the other hand, there is a huge rule that says you do not talk about this stuff. And what happened was that it kind of got deeper, and as it got deeper, they started operating this rule, which is an interesting and extraordinary rule of Japanese social interaction. And it's like this. This is what I found out in Japan. You're talking to somebody, and you say something, and you clearly finish it, and you hand the speech over to them, and instead of replying, they think about it. 5 seconds, even 10 seconds, they pause and then they something. And what they're doing is they're giving respect to what you've just said. They're giving it the respect of contemplation. So there is this silence. Now, for an English person, this is agony, right? There you are in social interaction. And shit, there's a silence. What's happening? Oh my God, have I said something? You know, what have I done wrong? And then he comes back, and then you realize that if you come straight back after what he said, it's like slapping him in the face, okay? He's giving you the respect, so you've got to do it back to him, right? So you have to repress every bloody conversational instinct that you've got in English and not reply for 5-10 seconds, which is a long time, okay? And then he does it, and then you do it, and that's how it goes. And once you get into it, once you've overcome the pain of silence, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. And they started doing it. And I started doing it back to them. And I'll tell you what I learned, partly by reading in between the silences, is this. We think that that's a frog poem, right? Because we go, but clearly the frog, the poem is about the frog, because the frog's the only thing that does anything, right? And we obviously think that he's the hero of the poem, you know? No, it's a pond poem, right? This poem is about the pond, and that is interrupted by the frog. Frogs are endearing in Japan. Interrupted by the frog, and then interrupted by the sound of water, and what the poem is really about is the silence that takes place after the poem finishes. In other words, it is about là où c'était. It is about there where no subject is. It is about the silence where there are no words. And what do I know? I don't even know Japanese. What Japanese people say is that this poem most perfectly of any of all of the haiku that there are, and there are millions, expresses that aha moment, aha feeling, ah like that, which is the exactly what object little A is. So the question is, how do you do that in English? There are many attempts to do haiku in English, of which the most famous is this one. This is by American William Carlos Williams. This is a very famous poem in America. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. Now you can see he's trying to get the aha, right? But the problem is he does that. So much depends upon. In other words, he tells you. Now that is completely out of order in the world of haiku. It's verbose. You must show, you mustn't tell. It is beautiful, but it betrays itself by using language, by using explanatory language. So how can you, in English, where always there is this urge not to be, and it's kind of busy, you know what I mean? It's not like the extraordinary silence of a perfect haiku. It's kind of, you know, it's worried. It's got stuff in it. How can you, in English, which has this urge to be verbose, express objet petit a? I will attempt to answer that next week. Thank you. Do you want to ask questions?